You are listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for downloading and subscribing. Coming to you virtually live from high atop the historic Raleigh building in beautiful downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B takes the listener behind the scenes to tell the stories of the people that contribute to the creation of the food and beverage community of North Carolina. And now, the misfits in the dish pit, the faces of the front. They are Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss, and we are here at Raffaldini Winery with the owner, the proprietor, the everything man, Mr. Jay Raffaldini. Thanks for having us.
Yep, you forgot to add check writer.
Check writer.
All you do is write checks.
Yes.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you guys for coming.
You didn't write us a check, though, yet.
Because I gave it to the guy who's in charge of Wilkesboro Tourism.
Perfect.
Is that why he's buying a new house? I'm not sure about that.
And obviously, Thomas Sally is here. So, Thomas, you, of course, have been our little concierge, taking us around all over the Wilkes County, Wilkesboro. You work for the Visitors Bureau. But you used to have a different job. The previous job that you had was you
everything but check rider and tractor driver
exactly
for Raffaldini for 12 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Thomas is a kid, so what did he start here when he was like 10?
Yeah, so we started drinking wine at 9 when I was in Italy, so he was at 10, so he's a late starter. And when I interviewed Thomas, it was kind of funny. So it was in 2007. And it was...
I would have been 23 then.
Exactly.
23. Sure.
It was 105 degrees. It was a scorching hot day. And I saw this guy drive up in a suit and tie. And I said, you know what? I'm going to make him do the interview outside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he did it. And he hung in there. And then he told me that his car had no air conditioning. So as soon as he left the property, he was shaking off all his clothes and stuff.
Jay didn't tell you about the time when he took his clothes off during the interview.
Exactly.
Well, I thought that was coming later. I mean, that was part of that, yeah.
As you can tell, Jay Raffaldini runs a real tight ship over here.
Yeah.
No, but we're here at Raffaldini where you are doing... What was this event that's going on right now?
So this event is called Wine Club Appreciation, and we have it every year. It's just a way to kind of give back to our most loyal members. Because we always ask them to support us, but the end of the day is we want to give back to them. So we have our best wines available for them to enjoy. We open up, we give them food, but it's our way of really kind of giving back because we want, you know, this to be a two-way street at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. And this year was a challenging year, but it turned out to be a cool, very successful year for us after all.
Sales-wise and vintage-wise?
Yeah, so half of that. So sales-wise, it was great.
Yeah.
We set sales records because I think you had two things happening. One is people were locked in their house. They couldn't go to restaurants or bars, so the next default proposition was vineyards. So we average about 20,000 visitors a year, but what was unusual about this year was a lot of them were first-timers rather than repeat. So I think these are people kind of like, I need to get out of the house and see what's out there because I'm going stir-crazy. We weren't closed down by the governor because we had, you know, more flexible rules.
Right.
And that was great. So we set sales records, but in terms of growing grapes, you know, this was probably one of the most challenging years that we've ever had. And when you look at vineyards that are growing grapes, we talk about challenging years, you're talking about how much rain did you get?
It was a very rainy year.
Record rainfall.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So that's about the place. I want to set this. So first of all, you know, Max and I... you don't know much about us, but we know our wine pretty well.
We're a big deal.
You guys wanted free wine.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's basically the heart of it. But no, in all seriousness, and Max talks about this, we've tasted a lot of North Carolina wine.
Yeah.
We've tasted some good North Carolina wine, but you were recommended to us in numerous occasions, said, oh, you got to try Raffaldini. They're doing some really good stuff there. So when Thomas was setting this up, we actually reached out and said, hey, we want to go see Raffaldini. And lo and behold,
proactive marketing.
We didn't know.
Thomas actually was trying to...
Who is this
fuck? He actually didn't do anything. So make those checks to us.
Exactly.
No, but seriously, so you're a guy that moved to the Yadkin Valley to make wine. I assume you're Italian based on the last name and the fact that you make Italian varietals. You were once on Wall Street, maybe, you know,
still,
good gun. Gagung. Oh, you still are actively still trading on Wall Street.
Indeed.
So you're the wolf.
Yes, exactly. So I started my career at Wall Street in 1985, and I had the good fortune of making a fair amount of dough in my 30s, which is the 90s. And I really wanted to, you know, I love wine. So when you have money, there's only two things you can do if you love wine: have a trophy cellar,
yeah,
or make a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make a business because I wanted to invest in the community, but also have something that my nieces and nephews and my daughter kind of eventually manage and run. And so I was thinking, I wanted to make a winery. So the choice is where. Because I was in New York, it kind of ruled out the West Coast. It's just too far to go back and forth.
Yeah.
And then if you look at the East Coast, you really have just three areas. You have the Finger Lakes, but I love red, so it's too cold. You have New York, really meaning, you know,
Hamptons,
Long Island, right?
Yeah. With
the North Fork, mm-hmm, mostly.
Of course.
The problem is that the main grape there is Cab Franc, and as Thomas knows, I hate Cab Franc.
Right? You just lost a bunch of street cred with our with our hipster listeners, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's called A Passing Fancy.
Yeah. She known.
Okay. She known. Exactly. Pet Nat, right?
Yeah.
And then you have Virginia. So these are the three wine regions. And when you look across from our villa to the mountains, that's Virginia. So I focused on Virginia, but the more I researched Virginia, I realized it wasn't quite hot enough to grow the style of grapes that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to grow central to southern Italian style grapes, and it's quite hot in that part of Italy. So I found North Carolina, and at the time there were six vineyards in North Carolina in the year 2000.
Okay.
So I hired a consultant from Napa Valley. We looked at 62 parcels of land until we found this one. It had to be the right, you know, right aspect, meaning face north and north and east, because it's somewhat cooling at night. You know, rocky, slopey, hilly, shitty, you know, land, and that's why I bought it. And that was 20 years ago.
So you were actively seeking a vineyard, and you found the place where you could grow what you wanted to grow.
Yep.
That's awesome.
That's
and it
fantastic.
Was here in the Yadkin Valley.
Yeah, but I didn't really, the problem was is that I knew what I wanted to grow, but I wasn't quite sure. So I planted a lot of Northern Italians, Central Italians, mostly Northern Italians, and I ripped them all
out. Like Nebbiolo, Barbera.
Ripped them out immediately. So I ripped out my entire vineyard three times.
Oh, wow.
So I ripped out 200,000 vines, which is expensive, right? Because I could have kept them, but they would have made average wine. And for us, it's about quality. So I said, you know what? That grape doesn't do well here. It's ripening too early versus where it ripened in Italy. That was my benchmark. So Barbera went, Nebbiolo went, Docero went, all the Northern Italians went, and I started to drift further south. I'm like, you know what? That Sangiovese tastes like a Sangiovese I had when I was little. My Patron.
Yeah.
So that makes sense because this is our kind of, our climatic issues are the same. So, and then we started to kind of, once we identify the varietal, here's the bitch nobody knows about, is you have all these different types of clones that make that grape.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that after this podcast, you're like, I want to start a vineyard for some reason, and you want to plant Chardonnay. There's 100 different types of Chardonnay clones that you could plant. Each has different regions. So once you have the right varietal, we had to figure out the right clone. And that was another ripping out session. So now we know what grows here from a varietal standpoint, what clone does well.
So what clone of Sangiovese?
So we tried Brunello, but it's a disaster, right? Because it's the wrong grape morphology. So the clone that does well is called Vino Nobile.
Oh yeah.
Does
yeah.
very well in North Carolina, and that's our main grape.
So okay.
Yeah, but it took us a while to figure out, because I love Brunello, but after 5 years, I'm like, this ain't a Brunello, let's bag it. You can only make so much rosé from Brunello.
Right.
And then it went to the reds.
And right now, we're drinking some delicious Vermentino, which grows quite well in Tuscany, or specifically Bulgari. But what I love about this Vermentino is high acid, but like all those tropical notes on the... Like you don't have any in your glass right now. But,
yeah, because it's after 11 o'clock, right?
So yeah.
I have a firm rule, no red before 11 a.m.
I see.
So this is my morning wine. And then, Vermentino's great, and we're going to taste some later. So Vermentino is the only white that I have.
Oh.
Because we're 80% red. And the Vermentino, basically, I make two ways. I have the style that you're drinking, which is this kind of like, I would say, Ligurian from the northwest part of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a one that's closer to Bulgari, which is kind of a little bit more fat and rich, which you actually dry in our drying rooms. You kind of get that richness. So I have one grape made two different ways.
Yeah. That's right. Well, that's the best thing about Vermentino because it grows so differently in Italy, like depending on where it is.
Yeah,
that's
it's
cool.
The reverse of a grape.
So you did it too, because you know the old joke in the wine business is there's pretty much one way to make money in the wine business, or how do you make a small fortune in the wine business? You start with a big fortune. Yeah, which you started with a big fortune.
Yeah, so. And I think this is a funny comment because what they don't understand when they say that is what they're saying is you can't make cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not a cash flow business.
Right.
It's a taxed advantage, meaning there's a lot of benefits, you know, to this business because we're a farm stuff, to invest in your property for the future.
Yeah.
So what this is a very capital intensive business, but once you cross that threshold, the cash flow, you never look back. So you got to lay out the big checks, and that's like a J curve, and then it explodes.
Mm.
So you have to survive. So the main mistake people make is like, let's start a vineyard. I'm 65, I'm going to retire. They run out of money in 6 years.
Yeah, and then they can't get to the other end of the J curve.
Exactly. Yeah. The hockey stick.
Their kids get to experience all the wealth.
They don't have to sell it. Exactly. Yeah. So it's really about, it's a next generational business. But if you know that, you can survive. The reason why you have so many successful vineyards in Europe is, in Europe, if you want a farm, there is no inheritance tax. In the U.S., there's an inheritance tax. It doesn't matter what business you own. So that land is passing tax-free generation after generation.
Yeah.
So they have no cost basis.
Plus, their J-curve started hundreds of years ago, literally, because everything's already paid off.
Exactly. The vines are productive.
Yeah.
Whereas every year, every generation, you got an estate tax. So this is why you have no fourth and fifth generation in the U.S., because they always have to sell the farm to pay the tax bill. Not in Europe. That's why they have the same owner for the past 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, you talked about family a little bit. You mentioned nieces, and you have a daughter as well. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So is your daughter's here? She's working on the vineyard? Or?
No, because I made a requirement for her. So she graduated in hospitality, tourism design, right? And she has to work for someone else for 5 years before she works for me.
Sure.
You have to see what it's like to work for a crappy boss you hate. He's making you do stuff you want to do. Because otherwise, she's just the daughter of the owner.
Yeah.
She's
got
the pick. So,
yeah,
and she's in year three. She's like, it's hard.
Can you tell us where she's working?
Yeah, she's down in Florida. And so she works for a place called Cooper's Hawk, which is this fast growing restaurant, wine cup.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yep, she's down in Florida. And she's like, she likes it. But she's like, you get up at 5 in the morning, you have a tourism. And welcome to the world. So that's part of my draw, right?
All right, but then you can potentially expect her to come back to the fold.
Oh yeah,
when it's time.
Yeah, and there's always a job. Like you have the ditzy niece who's doing the tasting room, you have the crazy uncle and driving the tractor. There's always a job for some unemployed.
Wait a second. Hold on right there. So you let the crazy uncle drive the tractor, but Thomas wasn't allowed to drive the tractor. What's up with that?
Because he's saying, that's why. I mean, somebody saved me here.
I get it.
He's a good driver.
He
almost lulled me to sleep on the way up here today. It was so cozy. It's getting a little warm in there. I'm like, I think I might take a little nap back here.
That's why he was quiet for a second.
I know. Believe me, every now and then, folks, Max doesn't speak. So you're making, obviously, primarily into red. So let's go through some of the intention that you have with your red wine portfolio. What are you making?
So we're 100% dry. We don't make anything sweet here because I think sweet wines are disgusting. I mean, they should be, and muscadine should be banned from humanity. Okay.
So you're going to really upset some North Carolinians there.
Quote me. We use muscadine to remove paint.
Okay. I mean, I don't disagree with you because I have yet to try a muscadine that I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I have yet to do that. But also, what with the hybrid grapes we were trying yesterday, right?
Well, Traminette is a hybrid grape.
It's a hybrid grape.
And
so
that did well, and Chambersin.
I want you guys, blah, blah, blah. You guys are foodies as well, right?
Sure, yes.
Go to a restaurant. Tell me, do you ever see the hybrids on the wine menu?
Almost never.
Probably not, exactly.
No,
because it's all about vinifera. Okay, European table grapes, because they're meant to go with food.
Right.
Hybrid other stuff are meant to be used as a cocktail, which is okay.
Sure.
But if you want to be in the back porch, something slightly sweeter, you know, these are designed because the acetone imbalance to be meant at the table. Because Europeans only drink wine when they eat. Otherwise, they're having a cocktail. So for us, we're all about Italian. Sangiovese, great piece to make Chianti. Montepulciano, it comes from Palazzo Abruzzo, east of Rome, where my mother's from. We have Montepulciano, which is our core grape, which is a little bit south of that area. And then, of course, we have Sagrantino, which is our main tannic, exactly. And then we, you know, the white Spermatino, and then a little bit Petit Verdot, used for blending purposes. And that's it.
Well, Matt and I enjoyed a nice bottle last night. What was the one?
It was the Montepulciano, the 2015.
Yeah,
it was
our best year, followed by 2019, which is in the barrels right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2019 was, when we say best year, we mean it was dry.
Yeah,
it was dry.
So let's walk through the beginning when you're first going. So we're talking about around 2000, right? When you first purchased the land, and then obviously you have to plant and you replanted and did all. But your experience of when did you get to the point where you're like, okay, now we're making what I've been trying to do? Because you're making really good wine now.
Yeah.
But I imagine it took a period. So what was kind of that? Where were you and what year was that when you thought, all right, now this place can actually do what we want?
I haven't got there yet.
Okay. Yeah.
Because my bar is so high.
Sure.
Because, you know, I had an indication when our 2017 Grande Reserva scored 97 points in San Francisco. I knew we were in this, potential was there. The 19s had that level of potential. The 19s and 17s, we had perfect weather. 18s to 20 were tough. So I kind of got, because I was kind of like, yeah, because you always want, you know, is it better to win in T-ball or lose to the Yankees? I'd rather lose to the Yankees. Mm.
Yeah.
So for us, our bar is the best in the best of the world. And we kind of scratched the surface with that 17. So we're getting there. And the key here is vine age. Because wines get better the older the vines get.
Yeah, and you're getting into the prime years of your vines. You just started again. So it's only going to get better. You got like another now 20 years of premium.
Oh, when our vines are great, I'll be dead, right? My daughter's taking over. She's inheriting all this capital, right?
No, but like 10 to 30 is like prime in terms of...
You're just scratching. Dude, I'm not 40 years old. I'm 60, right? So by the time this is kind of getting it, it's great. And vines are really at their... I'll see a peak in your 40 to 60. They're kind of like us. Think about the vines like us.
Oh, no.
And then they start to truncate, right?
Yeah, I agree. But then obviously, like, also in terms of, well, you probably, that's the thing I admire about you is you don't look at it so much like a business, because 10 to 30, not only are your grapes producing great wine, but they're producing prolifically. You're getting high yields relatively. But then once you go over 30, 35, you're getting great fruit, but less of it.
Exactly.
So.
And the response is you raise prices, right? Because the quality is so high. So, you know, when you look at, you know, our peers in Tuscany for the same wine that we make, or Montepulciano or Sagrantino, are $20, $30 higher than our price point. That's because the quality is that good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a function of those vines are 30, 40, 50 years old. So this area, and like Virginia, is going to get better as every year goes by because the vines are getting older. So it's just a function of time. And that's the challenge that we have.
How does it work with you and the winemaker? Because, you know, you have a winemaker. You're not the winemaker,
I'm that check writer.
There you go. He just called, by the way, and he said there's check ones that are big enough, but you can deal with that later. I assume you get involved in the blending?
That's where I'm involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Final blends. Yeah.
And so...
Well, like, in the hiring process, like, I think what Matt's getting at is a winemaker is an artist to an extent, you know, and just like a chef or whatever, and then there are owners of restaurants, but it's the owner of the restaurant wants the food menu to taste a certain way, but the chef has to actually do it. So in the hiring process, you've got to get someone that feels the same vibe that you feel so that you're getting there.
It's a very excellent question. So I tell him, this is our goal.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how to get there.
Right.
So he's got flexibility to figure out how to get there. Right. But this is, so I lay out the benchmark and he needs to figure out the journey. And that's where he and I kind of, it's more of a cooperative process. Like, you know what?
He's not in the room to argue this, so.
No, exactly, because he knows what the goal is.
Yeah.
But you got to give him a goal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you've been at a great restaurant, like, God darn, that veal is ridiculous.
Yeah.
How do I make that veal at home? So you know what the benchmark is? You got to have a benchmark in everything you do. So when we have all of our wines, we have a benchmark. This is the Holy Grail. Get me to there.
Yeah.
And then,
what is the bottle you show him?
Well, I show him four bottles. This is our benchmark for Matino, our benchmark Sangiovese, benchmark Sagrantino, our benchmark Montepulciano. And you have to tell me the path to get there and what it's going to take to get there.
Yeah.
I will invest in everything we need to get there, but that you need to get there. So
that's something that we were just, Matt and I were talking about. One of my favorite bosses, it was in the wine industry. He moved up the corporate ladder really quick. He was a lot younger than I am. And one of his really great perspectives on leadership was he would always tell me, he's like, manage up. Meaning if to your superiors, ask more of your bosses, ask more of them. Because if your boss says, if Jay Raffaldini says to me, and I'm the winemaker, I want the best.
I want Sassicaia.
I want you to make it me the best. I want a Sassicaia here in North Carolina. Then your response should be, okay, this is what I'm going to need.
Exactly.
And then and you go through the process. And me in this hypothetical as the winemaker needs to be able to know that don't expect there to be restraints, or don't answer for my boss before you go there like, well, it's impossible because we don't have this, and this. Let him figure that problem out. That's your burden as the boss, as the check writer. Exactly. It's like, cool. And so that leads me to, and you told this earlier in the barrel room. It was a little loud, so I'd rather have you tell me again. Talk about your barrel room and what you did, because it's pretty extensive.
Yeah, so the typical barrel holds about 20 cases of wine, but I felt that it imparted too much oak flavor. What oak does, if you have a shitty wine, you drop an oak bomb on it, and then everybody loves it because oak is sexy, right? But the problem is it masks a lot of problems, and I wanted that. So I had these huge barrels that are about, you know, that are, you know, about 10 to 11 times the size of a normal barrel. So I wanted the ratio of wine to wood. There was wood to wine,
yeah,
you know, to be lower, because I wanted to show the quality of the fruit.
The impact of it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Basically, I mean, you're swimming naked. Right? There is no there is no kimono over you. So this is what I do, is not being bothered by oak. And that was a very humbling experience when we first started, but it taught us a lot.
Yeah.
Like, you went, this is wrong because of this, and it allowed us to adjust. Because at the end of the day, it's about quality, quality, quality. And
well, sometimes people would like use a new oak barrel. A new French oak barrel is going to be intense when it comes to the flavoring agent, if you will. Yeah. So then a lot of times you use what they call neutral, which have to be at least, what, like three, five years or whatever of use.
Technically two, but
three, after it's been used,
two, they're still imparting some flavor, yeah.
Right. So that's an idea. Like, okay, well, let's get some neutral barrels or used barrels effectively. And then I imagine you probably experimented with both of those ideas, and then you're like, well, wait a minute, if you can't go any less than a neutral barrel, what do? You increase the size.
Exactly, because we want oxygen exchange to happen, whereas if you put it in stainless steel, there's no oxygen. So this allows the oxygen to exchange without any oak getting a part into it, which is, I love it.
Yeah.
And for our whites, we're actually getting some concrete eggs.
Oh.
And allows oxygen to pass through without opening in. Because oxygen benefits are great. Because once it's in stainless steel, it's never going to change.
Yeah.
Because it's inert. So the goal here is to really kind of refine and see what capable to. So
they're barriques, right? Is that what
No, they're botis.
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 B-O-T-T-I.
Botis. So I love hearing that, but I'm also surprised here, because if you're trying to make like Vino Nobile, those wines are heavily oaked. Or very often heavily oaked, but that makes me think of that. Like, this is your benchmark. When you say your benchmark, like, you don't want a replica of that. From what I'm understanding, you want the best version of what North Carolina can do. But that's just the quality standard.
Exactly, it's the quality benchmark.
Yeah.
The aromatics, the tannin profile, the acidity. That's what we shoot for.
You're not if you're going to cover a song, you don't want to make it sound the same. You want to do your version of it, but you want it to be of the highest quality.
Yeah. We're not a cover band here. We're trying to be the next two.
Well, like when Eric Clapton did "I Shot the Sheriff," he didn't do Bob Marley's Indeed. Shot the Sheriff.
Indeed.
And both stand on their own as pretty cool songs. So it's to the listener of what you would prefer.
Well, the Chris Cornell thank you song, I would argue, is better than the Led Zeppelin original.
Oh, that's controversial, but
yes.
I love me some Chris Cornell, so that's all right.
So you know, the issue we have is demand for our wines is higher than our capacity to make the wines, because you know, we have 20,000 people a year coming through this place. I mean, it's a shit show in terms of how busy it is. That's why Thomas quit. He needed an easier job. That's why he quit.
Yeah, he was busy.
By the way, can we speak to the... you've kind of got like the... You're like the mayor of your own town in here. And by the way, for people that are concerned, like the COVID stuff and all, and like whatever, you have everybody outside, and everyone was sitting at their tables and they're doing their thing. So like, you know, you're outdoors, you're doing your thing. But what I noticed was the camaraderie really fast. We come upon this place, the parking lot's packed. You've got everyone enjoying themselves. We're looking outside. We're inside right now just because of the sound, and we needed a quiet room.
Kissing.
But, I mean, you've got a nice little group of people out here. Yeah. Little ass grabbing. That was me and Matt. Have you seen it? It's like two apples. But anyways, you have a great camaraderie. I mean, even just now, you went into this room, and I saw like five forlorn faces.
I saw that
of
too,
people
right?
that were like, "Oh, Jay's going away to go to the party.
He's gonna pause."
I saw that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're the life of your own party over here. Yeah. As Robert says in our fantasy football league, he calls me COA. Center of attention. You're the COA of Raffaldini, but it's because you kind of lead by example, and you want people to enjoy themselves and have fun, so you do that.
Well, I think, you know, to your point is, I think you want to associate a dream with someone. This is my dream, so they want to see my passion, right? And they get my energy and my... Exactly. So the owners of businesses have to be the best marketers. Mm-hmm. You have to be the brand yourself.
Yeah.
So this is why a lot of owners are like, I'm not a sales guy. Yeah, we're all sales guys.
Yeah.
All we do is sell ourselves all day long.
Right.
So you need to be upfront and up center and communicating, because these people will follow me anywhere because they are connected to me spiritually and physically and see the drink.
Jay, that's a hard thing to do in North Carolina. Like, you set yourself a barrier to entry right from the beginning. I mean, you said it yourself, but you're breaking down those barriers. But what is your... You seem to me as a visionary. So how do you drive this North Carolina wine scene forward?
So there's two things. One is, it's a fish pond thing.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather be a small fish in a big pond or a big fish in a small pond?
Mm-hmm.
I chose the latter.
Yeah.
Right, because if you're a big fish in a small pond, you can kind of quasi-determine the future of things, mm-hmm. by your passion, your financial commitment. And I chose North Carolina because I thought I could really drive the quality here, mm-hmm. which is why I started NC Fine Wines with Jones Vandrail to kind of plant a flag. There's got to be a minimum standard here.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do slushy machines. You can't have wine Ritas in a bag. That's the road to poverty. You got to focus on quality. And be the restaurant. When you go to a restaurant, you want to be... I want North Carolina red. That's when we've made our mark. Mm-hmm. We're the default red at a nice restaurant. We have a ways to go, but it's only by moving the bar forward and challenging people that we're able to get there.
So you're saying that the answer is just continue on quality. I mean,
always, and push.
As a salesperson, I sold wine professionally for 7 years, and then just as a wine person in restaurants selling a wine portfolio, I've been doing it for 20 years. I knew what different regions gave me. I'm looking at a picture. You have a Domaine de Michel, Châteauneuf du Pape. I know what Châteauneuf du Pape is, and I know what the flavor profile is, and I know where it comes from, and it's marketable. I get it. I know that New Zealand gets me that Sauv Blanc.
Yeah.
I know that up in Washington, I'm going to, you know, get a nice Cab or Cab Franc even. But what the fuck do I get from North Carolina?
You don't know yet.
Right.
Because it's too early. And Virginia and Long Island did figure out Cab Franc for a while. Virginia is maybe coalescing on Viognier. They're not sure yet. Even they don't know. And they're 20 years ahead of us.
Right.
So we don't know what you can do in North Carolina.
But because you have this influence, and with people like Jones Vandrail and other, you know, Sanctuary and other great winemakers in the area, could you guys all just start making like one type of wine together and challenge each other and say, hey, let's all do this
one. My Montepulciano is better than yours.
But that's actually said that because, so I bought this land and then I invited, so land came up for sale around me and Dr. Piccioni bought land next to me.
Yeah, he's right down. We saw him coming up.
Yep. And then three other places bought land on the other side of me. And it's called Sotrio, Castello Barone, and Due Barche. So we have five Italian vineyards contiguous to each other. We're all growing Vermentino and Montepulciano in common. Just so you could see how Montepulciano can taste different from each other when it's adjacent to each other. Mm-hmm. It's how you grow it, the yeast you use, the process of winery. So that's the process. So in maybe three or four years, you're going to be able to taste five Montepulcianos and five Vermentino all in the same place.
That's because cool. The usefulness, though, of this, effectively, we're talking about branding. We're talking about branding the region. And I think the only way, because what we've discovered and what Matt and I, it's like now kind of a recurring theme, is that now we're trying these wineries' wines specifically. We're getting inside their portfolio in North Carolina and discovering some really good product.
Yep.
So it's breaking the conventional thought of that North Carolina can't make great wine. But the problem is, or at least perceived problem is, they're all so scattered and also very different. And the only way that you're actually going to know is if you yourself are dedicated and you want to go find
You have to find it, exactly.
But how does the Somm in, just say, Chicago, that has a great portfolio and wants to do esoteric cool things, now it's cool, they could say, hey, there's this guy doing Italian style wines that's really good and Raffaldini is great, and it's really hard to connect that to the audience, to your audience.
Almost impossible. So you have to enter the wine competitions. So when we got the 97, people sought us out.
Hmm. But like, I want to ask Matt on this question. Like, did New Zealand all just sit in one room and say, we're all going to make Sauv Blanc? Like, how did Sauv Blanc become so specific to New Zealand and then marketed so well?
Well, on the South Island and the very north end on Marlborough, it grows prolifically. They had vineyards planted, and also they had a lot of flyover winemakers saying that, no, Sauvignon Blanc is what you want to make here. And then it became a signature style.
Right, but no Paul Hobbs or somebody isn't coming here like he did with Argentina or whatever.
Not yet. Paul Hobbs is for hire. If you want to hire him, you know, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. But when somebody comes here to say, like, you know what, North Carolina.
Nobody comes here.
But my perspective was that when I first got here, people said, what do they make? I just said Cab Franc. That's what I thought. I'm like, yeah, North Carolina makes Cab Franc. But the first thing you said out of your mouth was that you don't like Cab Franc. So I'm like, okay, well then let's throw that out the window. And you're making, for what everyone else thinks, more esoteric wines because they're Italian and not a lot of people even know how to say Montepulciano.
Exactly.
So that's not going to relate to the rest of the community. I mean, Raffaldini singularly can be fantastic and can do its own thing, but it's not going to connect to the whole consortium of wineries. So
it'll take decades.
Right.
That's the issue. We're going to take decades.
It's that J curve you're talking about.
Exactly, because remember, Virginia is ahead of us.
Yeah.
And they are still kind of cold. Virginia's known for wines, but you don't know what wine they're known for. But
I would
say
Cab Franc. I mean, I think that's what.
You know, they make good wines.
Yeah.
But Napa, yeah. Cab, you know, Paso, you know, Syrah, and then you go to Lodi, it's Zin, whatever, right? So, but they don't have that yet there. So we are behind them.
Right. Yeah. So I do think there needs to be a better marketing agent to understand. But
To think that through, to take it to the next step is, so let's say you guys Montepulciano, you do Montepulciano well. And you're going to have five people growing Montepulciano. So people will start to recognize and say, oh, Montepulciano. And Montepulciano or Barbera or Sangiovese is starting to become in the lexicon of regular wine drinkers. Well, they're actually go to a restaurant or a wine store and say, hey, do you have a good Barbera? Do you have a good Montepulciano? The one thing about Montepulciano, though, is I would say people recognize that as a more of a table wine price.
Like
$14.99 is the kind of top end. And I believe I don't know for sure.
$33?
$33.
1,000 cases, can't keep it in stock.
Well, yeah. There you go.
Well, so you're selling it, so that's fine. So
what do you need us for? You don't need us.
Who the fuck are you guys anyway? How'd you get in here? Security!
Well, that was a perfect way to finish our conversation with Jay Raffaldini, quite a character and a visionary here in North Carolina in the wine trade. Be sure to visit them at raffaldini.com, join their newsletter and their wine club, and get out to his winery. It's a beautiful property and a fantastic weekend getaway. We continue our conversation about winemaking in Wilkes County.
County with one of the four proprietors of Elkin Creek Vineyards and Winery. But first, a word from our sponsors. I'm talking about Triangle Wine Company, purveyors of fine wine and craft beer. The Triangle Wine Company offers local delivery, in-store pickup, curbside service, wine shipping, and keg rental. With locations in Morrisville, Cary, Holly Springs, Southern Pines, and soon to be Raleigh, they are here to service the community for all of your beverage needs. And be sure to use the NCFB promo code to receive a nice discount when placing your orders. Visit TriangleWineCo.com or call them at 1-800-919-7518. This episode is also brought to you by Boss Coffee USA, Japan's number one coffee brand, coming to you here in North Carolina, well, technically all over the Americas, because it's available on Amazon.com. Coming in three flavors, black, vanilla, and cafe au lait, Boss Coffee is flash brewed, which means it's brewed hot and then chilled fast for optimal flavor. Make sure that when you are purchasing your Boss Coffee on Amazon, you use our promo code, which is NCFBPODCAST. You will receive 10% off your purchase because we like you a lot. So thank you for listening. Thank you for enjoying Boss Coffee. And now back to the show.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss, and we are here at the beautiful Elkin Creek Vineyard, and we are here with the winemaker, Louis Jarislow.
Hello. Thanks for being here. It's really nice to see you guys.
Well, it's fantastic coming here. We have been on quite a journey today, all over Wilkes, Wilkes County, Wilkesboro, starting to understand the difference between
North Wilkesboro.
What that means. This is a podcast, so you can't see what's happening, but if everyone's quiet for a second, you can kind of hear that's the Elkin Creek flowing down. We just got here, and this is where we're staying this evening.
You can feel it. Feel nearby. It, yeah.
But it's
and as I was saying, it's also a beautiful drive up here, even though you can't see it, but you're on these back kind of windy roads, and you know it's tucked way back. So nice.
One of the things I think that we all really loved and envisioned before the move really happened is that we really wanted to find a place that was secluded but not remote. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you could get any more accurate to describe when you're coming in here and you get, you know, off of our main north-south thoroughfare in Elkin, and you turn off of Bridge Street onto Carter Mill Road, and we're 1 mile off Carter Mill Road. We're 3 minutes from an Ingles and a, you know, Dollar General and a Food Lion. But when you come into the property, up and over the shape of our particular hill and the geology of our site, you get into this, by the time you get to our tasting room and you get out of the car and all you hear is the waterfall behind the mill, and you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's a really special property. It's a really special site.
The move, as we should mention, you are of Blue Man Group fame. You and your partners, the Whites in here, your wife, and even one of your managers on the property. How did you find this place? And I know that you got married here, right?
Nick and Jennifer.
Oh, Nick and Jennifer got married here. And so did they find it and they recruited you?
They did. They had been looking for a destination wedding, quote unquote, to be closer to where their family are here in the Mid-Atlantic. So Nick grew up in High Point and spent a lot of time between High Point and where his grandma lived, which is called Zephyrs near Dobson.
Okay.
And Elkin is in between. And so he had spent a lot of time going to visit his grandma. He saw a lot of the vineyards in the early phase of the Yadkin Valley growth, which was mid to late 90s and into the early 2000s. It really exploded. 2003 is when the AVA, the Yadkin Valley Viticulture Area, was officially designated by the federal government. So it was during that time, and he saw all of this happening, and they thought, why don't we try to find a vineyard and winery that we could have the wedding? And it's near grandma's, it's near my parents, Jennifer's family's in Tennessee and Mississippi at the time. And they had been looking and visiting and made multiple trips. They'd visit family, but they'd travel around and go visit wineries and never quite found the right vibe. And they were back in Vegas and looking back on the internet, looking for other places to visit on the next trip. And Jennifer had been scrolling through some photos and found a picture that was a picture of that spot I was talking about earlier. It's the confluence of our two creeks on the property, the Big Elkin Creek and intersects right behind the tasting room, the Grassy Creek, which is on the other side of our property. And right behind us, those two creeks merge and become one. Mm. And for obvious metaphor purposes, that's our wedding spot. That's where the ceremonies happen. Then saw the vineyard and tasted the wine and talked more about the event. And that was it. They fell in love with the place, and this was the place they had their wedding.
And how long after their wedding did they actually... did they move here and purchase the property?
So we were part of the wedding. Carrie, my wife, is our officiant. She was the minister for that wedding too. She married them.
Okay.
And I was part and parcel, and I came along. And since I was going to be here, we talked about, well, what kind of things can we do to add the theater magic to the experience that we're going to have here? And after visiting, I was... had some ideas about some lighting and the music and
how everybody's gonna be painted blue.
And then we're gonna splash paint all over the place. You're okay with that, right?
Who knows who's listening to our show? They'll be like, Blue Man Group, I don't know what that is. We know what it is. It's been really popular for a really long time, but maybe just give a refresher so people can understand what that means.
It was really interesting when I started with the company, which was not at the beginning, but fairly early. And there was still a lot of people who had no idea what Blue Man Group was, and trying to explain to them. And then things started to shift. And at one point, I remember Phil Stanton, one of the creators of the show, one of the original Blue Men. And we were talking about going to this particular store or hardware supplier or contract, you know, place that we use all industrial materials to build the instruments and a lot of the scenery and our sculptures. And that's the stuff that I was involved with, was building special effects and instruments and kinetic sculptures and fluid mechanics, all the weird stuff. I was one of the mad scientists. So, and I said something about maybe we could just call them and ask if they could special order this thing. And he said, well, you would probably have a better chance of doing that. They know you better than they know me. They don't know who I am. And this is like the creator of the show saying this to me. And so there was a shift at one point, and then all of a sudden the snowball started rolling. And then before we knew it, the first album came out and it went gold. And then we were opening a show in Las Vegas, and then we were opening a show in Berlin and Tokyo and London and Orlando, and it just kind of went on and on. And then the Pentium commercials happened. That was also a big shift.
I am now remembering seeing the Blue Man Group in San Francisco. I believe it was at the Kern Theater, or maybe the Orpheum. It was one of the two big theaters. It might have been the Orpheum.
Was it the Rock Tour in the Tenderloin?
I think it was, because now I'm like, oh my God.
I was on that tour.
Really?
That was brutal.
It was when I was still...
like a brutal undertaking, or you're not happy with the...
No, at that particular venue, we needed a big shoehorn to cram... It was seven semi-trucks of stuff.
Oh,
and like we had four tour buses full of crew and performers and opening bands, and that show was never meant to fit inside that space. We're in the Tenderloin district.
Yeah, and the Tenderloin is like not too different than like Times Square. Like if you think about like just the everything is jammed in. It's a small, tight space.
But before the Disneyfication of Times Square, like
when the it was old still school Times
old school Times Square, was a little shady.
Yeah, yeah, guys were still pooping on the corner. That's definitely the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days.
Yeah. People. So the Blue Man Group was a Broadway production. It involved music and performance, but the interesting thing was that you were doing it all. You're creating music out of non-musical instruments, right?
Right. Found objects and industrial materials.
By the way, you guys were all painted blue.
Painted blue and don't talk.
And never speak.
I mean, there's voiceover dialogue in some of the pieces.
Sure.
But the Blue Man character does not speak. I started in 1997. And then left officially in 2012 when we moved here.
Wow.
And Carrie and Jennifer and Nick were all involved for 12 years at different time frames, but for 12 years.
Well, just as those two creeks joined the union down to one, both of you two as two separate couples kind of fused together to do what you're doing here, which I find to be really cool. I mean, heck, the Weisses and the Trujillos both kind of found a center to connect again in North Carolina, as we had both been like bi-coastal, if you will, and then we found a center out here. So I think we kind of understand what that means to like work together as a unit. And so the two couples then decided to come here.
And wanted to be closer to our family. At this point, I'd lived all kinds of places in the United States and not ever close to my parents again, where, you know, and as our family, our parents and grandparents are getting older, we really wanted to move closer to home, so which meant the East Coast. So we had began different career paths, all of us individually, to do different things and try to figure out how are we going to have a subsistence moving back to this area. And I've been in the theater since I was a little kid. My whole life has been, I went to magnet program schools as a junior high kid and auditioned, got into a magnet program for high school, and then I went to an arts college here in North Carolina. I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, Winston-Salem, and had a career in rock and roll and touring and theater and lighting design and production managing, and before I got involved with Blue Man. I mean, that was the whole, I had a whole career before Blue Man, and continued it to an extent while I was with Blue Man, and take leave of absence and go on tour with some metal bands as their lighting director and go and do this project. And and so the idea of leaving the business was almost unattainable, you know,
unimaginable,
unapproachable to think about, well, what would I do? Like, what would I do? And we had looked at other theaters and theater organizations. I looked at going back on tour with bands and really good money, but you're never home. And that was a non-starter. So we had all started different career paths, different ways. Mine, which was, I guess, the kind of askew left turn more than anybody else's, but I went back to school and I got a degree in aviation science and put myself through flight training and became a commercial helicopter pilot.
Flight instructor. Read that and it was like, wait a minute.
You did what?
For 2 years, you were a flight instructor, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In helicopters.
In helicopters. And I was teaching people to fly in Vegas to build
nuts.
My, you know, that's how you do. You go through your training. I did the college program, not only help facilitate the flight training, but also as you know, resume builder, and also kind of build out my toolbox, my broad comprehension of the industry, so that I could be more employable in different ways. I could manage a company. I could run an airport. I could work for air traffic control. Like, I knew a lot of the different, you know, more deeper level stuff than just going through the flight training as a pilot would. And so I had students in various different levels of training and was teaching people to fly from zero all the way to becoming an instructor themselves. And that's how you build your hours. And so you build your hours as a pilot to a certain level where then you can start applying for jobs, like real jobs as a pilot.
Yeah.
And in Las Vegas, the easiest transition would be to apply for a tour job flying people to Grand Canyon all day. And there's a ton of helicopters. It's like a hornet's nest of helicopters flying back and forth all day. And you get a job doing that for a while, and you fly these bigger turbine helicopters, and you build hours in those aircraft.
Huh.
Then you can apply for the next tier job from there. And ultimately, what I wanted to do was do medevac. Like, I wanted to be like a, you know, a care flight, a life flight medevac pilot. They call it HEAMS operation. And that was a goal for me. It felt like that would be very fulfilling and rewarding, but also, as all the other endeavors I'd had in my life, including winemaking, equally challenging. And you're always a student, and there's always, you know, a continual growth and challenge, and it's also a bit unique, pretty different than most people, you know, might do. And so that was right up my alley. And that's, you know, I still fly, but just for fun these days.
But so, okay, for those that are just like understanding this right now, you're a winemaker.
Now I make grape juice.
We haven't gotten to the point where you're making wine.
I got involved with brewing and winemaking as a hobby.
Okay.
I had always appreciated wine. I always enjoyed wine and appreciated the styles, the grape varieties, the history, the regions. I just thought it was really cool, especially the history. I'm a big, I really appreciate history buff. I had read several references to winemaking practices when learning about, like, well, the monks in Burgundy did this,
mm-hmm.
and the purpose was that, and they would do batonnage in the barrels. I'm like, what is that? I don't know anything. Like, not only do I not know what that is, but I don't even know the winemaking process. And at that point in my life, I thought, well, that was just really dumb. I should I should know how to make wine.
Were you avid wine drinkers, you and your wife?
I wouldn't say avid, but I appreciated wine. Probably me more than her at that, you know, at that time. And I just, so I as I would do with some things, I went and I got some books. And I just started reading these books about winemaking because I thought, this is a hole in my education. I shouldn't, like driving stick shift. Like I should know how fermentation works in making a craft beverage. And so I read all these books about winemaking and caught the bug. Like just reading about it was like, wow, this is sounds really fun. And I'm certainly not intimidated by the chemistry. And I firmly grasped all the concepts and a little bit of math and some formulas and like, this sounds really fun. I gotta try this. So I bought the kit of all the like equipment you get, the startup equipment kit. And I bought one of those wine kits that you make where you like rehydrate this and you add packet number three and you stir this and then you wait a week and then you do this. And so I followed the instructions implicitly. I did exactly step by step. And I finally, I had all the equipment, my own little rabbit ear corker and everything. And I bottled my first wine and corked it. And you wait 3 weeks for it to stabilize and the cork to swell and do all its thing. And it goes through bottle shock. And I finally opened my first wine, so excited, poured a glass of it, and it was awful. It was terrible.
I appreciate that's what you said, because if you would have said it was awesome, I'd be like, man.
No, I call BS. No, it was, it wasn't undrinkable, but it was like Bartles and Jinks.
Yeah,
it was
just like sweet.
It was sweet, and it was light, and it was thin, and there was no body, and it didn't have, it was just flabby and missing everything.
Yeah.
So I was really upset about that, like angry. I was angry because I followed the instructions. I did exactly. So I went back and I got the
damn you kit.
Yeah, I know. Right? So I went and I got the exact same kit.
Okay. I'm going to try it again.
And I'm going to try it again, step by step. But every step, it's like, okay, open up packet number three and pour it in the bucket. What is packet number three? How much of packet number three? Okay, 5 grams of what? Of potassium metabisulfite or bentonite powder or, okay, well, what does that do? Here come the books. Books come out, flip, reading about, oh, okay, I see. Well, is that enough? It's going to be about 6 gallons pre-fermentation, 5 grams to the, okay, that's legit. Next step. And then each step as I went, and then I got my little titrator kits and I could test the acidity and I could sample for different qualities like the tannin structure. I got the hydrometer going and figured out the specific gravity of the liquid and figured out, oh, this doesn't have enough sugar. This isn't going to have enough alcohol to really balance the fruit character. Well, how do I adjust that? Well, there's a formula. You'd be like 2 ounces of sugar per gallon. It will adjust the degrees of Brix, is how we measure dissolved solids in the wine, by this much, etc. Okay, we'll doctor that up. Next step, add a little tannin. This needs a little more acid. Add some acid powder. Like, you know, really learning how to manipulate the levers. Went through the process. It's in the carboy. Bottled the wine. Waited my 3 weeks. Finally, like, popped that cork. Okay, here we go. Next step. Let's see how this went. Take a sip of that wine. Okay, that's better.
You got
better.
To, like,
that's better.
Somewhat like, wine.
Not awesome.
Yeah.
But, aha.
But what we're saying is you are a self-taught winemaker.
Until we knew that we were going to be coming here, and then I had to step up my game and I took some classes. Not long after that point, the training wheels came off, and then I started just completely abandoned the kits and started making wine from recipes and from old timey, like, I want to make some monk stuff. What do we got? Like Mellow Mel. It's like mead with fruit infusion and stuff that monks were making back in the way back before we knew that the vineyard was really going to happen. Discovered that I could fly from McCarran Airport in Las Vegas to Sacramento for like $60, rent a car, and in about 40 minutes from then, I was standing in the front door of the of UC Davis.
Yeah, at arguably one of the greatest wine schools.
It's like the Mecca. Yeah. And they have an extension program, and so I could fly in, spend a week, do extension classes, and then and it was the specific stuff that I felt like I had a hole in my education, like the lab stuff, like understanding really the proper professional lab equipment that would be used for making wine in this volume and really dialing in the chemistry side of it. Really, I'm always trying to capture the potential of the Yadkin Valley. So we are in the foothills of the Blue Ridge and Brushy Mountains here in North Carolina. And as you have heard before, North Carolina is the original wine region of the United States, back to the colonies, until Prohibition. But that's because the French explorers back in the 1690s wrote back to France, and Sir Walter Raleigh's explorers wrote back to England as well, talking about the native grapes growing where they had landed, which we now know as the Cape Fear River.
Yeah.
And they were native grapes all over the place, and the Native Americans were cultivating them and using them for food as one of their staples. Flash way forward. So here we are in the foothills, which also creates a microclimate. It's a rain shadow from the mountains and creates a bit of a pocket of a moderated climate here. But our soil is a sandy loam clay, which is most similar of all to Terra Rossa soil associated with Tuscany. Terra Rossa is also recognized in the Right Bank Bordeaux, Cunawara, Australia, Castilla-La Mancha in Spain, parts of Argentina, and the Yadkin Valley, North Carolina. But it makes a bit more sense because the Appalachian Mountains were some of the oldest mountain range on Earth. And these hills that we happen to be in were formed at the same time as the Pyrenees and the Himalayas. And they used to be attached. It was during Pangaea.
Yeah.
And all of this collision and uplift was at the same time 300 million years ago. And as the continents drifted apart, North America rotated almost 90 degrees. That's why we find dinosaurs in Canada. It was the tropics back then. And so here we have this very, very weathered, because we have rain and erosion, and over there they do not.
I was just going to say
that. Yeah, the erosion is a huge difference. Mount Everest is still Mount Everest because it's arid, and the Pyrenees and, you know, Tuscany. But the there's a slight difference in the geology, whereas this we have more...
That would imply that the Earth was round.
Well, right. Well, that's I would never suggest that.
You're implying
I wouldn't want to alienate any of the audience.
For the wines, are the wines available beyond the winery? Like, can somebody access these wines, or do you only get them if you come here? Like, how does one come across?
We're not really distributing at this point. We don't even make that large of a volume to like really be in distribution in stores. The wine is mostly sold here, you know, point of sale. But we also have some wines at local wine shops and some restaurants, but we also ship.
You do like
so
a
we
wine
have
club
our wine club ships both mostly within North Carolina by our wine club, but we ship out of state through a third party fulfillment that maintains all the permits and the paperwork and everything. Mm-hmm. So we have wine club members across the United States.
Oh, cool.
And so we do ship. Yeah. It wasn't terribly long. Jennifer will remember exactly how many months. It was just months, 6 months, 9 months, 3 months. There was some kind of clamor about what would it look like if we took over the vineyard. And of course, our first reaction was, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like we, you know,
but
how would
secretly
we,
you're like,
we'd have
wait.
To create, well, you know, that's what we asked for. Like we asked the universe for a place like this, and there's a possibility that we could have that, and that's like
be careful what you ask for,
right?
Yeah.
And so it pretty quickly turned into logistics. Like, okay, well, how would we do that? Like, well, you know, the business as it exists now, the way Mark was running it, would not be enough to provide for two families. And we're just, so what would we do? Well, we could definitely do more weddings. We can run events. So let's just really market the weddings and events and special events and dinners and stuff, and we could really do that. Our tasting room, by the way, Mark built it.
Oh, wow.
Mark started the vineyard altogether. He bought this old grist mill as his house in the early to mid 90s, and then somewhere in the late 90s decided with the adjacent property that neighbors had, he bought this property on this side from neighbors, and then down 10 acres on the other side where the cabins are from other neighbors on that side, and expanded the property to about 40 acres and decided to start the vineyard around 99 2000. The building upstairs was built originally as a restaurant, fully functional restaurant, and it ran from when he had completed it in about 2005 up until 2010. And so the restaurant is also a premier function of what we could do with the space. So we could cater the weddings and events here, we eventually built this pavilion. We started construction of it before we even made the transition. And then we thought, well, we could really increase the events, leveraging the kitchen and the tasting room. We could increase the wine production, and we'd have a bit of a captive audience with more events for the wine, and then really market and promote being, you know, the young upstart kids, you know, like sure. We felt a lot more comfortable with promoting online and promoting through Facebook and building our, you know, online presence and brand. And then decided, what about building cabins? Like, what if we have lodging on the property, make it really a destination? And that turned into, let's build four.
Right.
We ended up building these four, which are studio floor plan that have fold-out couch, so they could accommodate a family and plenty of space.
And that's where we're staying tonight.
Yeah, we're excited to go see that.
And I know that, I think we're talking about a pizza party or something that's happening.
Our wood fire pizza.
The wood fire.
Every week. That was started by Mark.
Yeah.
So when the restaurant closed down, and they used the wood fire oven to great effect when the restaurant was open.
Yeah.
And it was full on wood fire brick. There's no gas assist or anything. It was 100% hardwood.
Which is a total pain in the ass, by the way.
It is. Well, that's Nick. I mean, he's got it to a science about the way he would describe it himself. Is that making the pizzas and really getting them absolutely perfect, like the way to his standard, it's really about managing the fire as much as it is about making the dough 2 days before and proofing it. We make the dough from scratch, all the toppings prepared fresh. I mean, Nick is in there slicing tomatoes, slicing the pepperoni, sauteing the onions, sauteing the spinach. I mean, all of the toppings are made fresh every week.
Yeah.
And it takes days to get ready for pizza day. So our pizza day is pretty premier, like in the area. We'll have people come from other wineries. Like, they've been referred. They'll be doing a tasting at another winery and say, you know, where should we go for lunch? What do you recommend? And people would look at them funny and say, it's Sunday. You should go to Elk and Greek and have the pizza. Of course, since COVID, we've had to do things a little bit differently. We've always taken reservations.
Yeah.
Not required, but definitely recommended, because we run out of dough. It's all from scratch. We only have so much.
Yeah.
And so you can reserve your dough before you come.
Oh, nice.
Now, whereas now, it's a bit more formalized. So you reserve your dough and the time that you're going to be here, and we hold a table for you outdoors. We have outdoor seating spaces covered. I think we, the four of us, were well aware that we were in a unique position, having that much experience with an organization like Blue Man Group, where it is such a deeply collaborative environment all the time. And you just got to check your ego at the door. You bring your ideas that you think are best, and ultimately you trust that everybody has the same thing in mind, which is the best of the project. Nobody's out to just like my idea won over someone else's. What is the best for the goal, and what is the best for the project?
You've got a lot of chapters to your life story that are wildly different from the next.
I'm only halfway.
Yeah. Yeah, what's next?
What's next? I don't know, astrophysics, microbiology, nanoparticles.
I'm thinking more low tech, like quilting. Like, try that.
Knitting. You know,
yeah. Like, that
crochet.
Could be, I mean, hey.
Nobody's crocheting.
If you're going to do it, you're going to do it really well, I bet.
Well,
you know.
You can give it a shot. I like learning new things.
You have carved out this nice little habitat where at least the four main players all have their own role. Thank you for letting us into your place. We'll try not to trash it. I mean, our favorite band's Led Zeppelin, so we might throw a TV through the window.
You know my background, right? Zeppelin's pretty tame.
Is that tame?
Yeah.
But thank you so much. We're going to see you this whole weekend, which is nice. And so I appreciate it. Matt, what else you got?
Well, come out to Elk and Creek. You will eat and drink very merrily.
And before we get out of here, I want to speak to you about Proof Alcohol Ice Cream. That's right. Think differently about your dessert, because now in a new year, they brought back an old favorite. I'm talking about their bourbon chocolate cherry ice cream. First released last year, they brought it back again for the second time because it's so delicious. Made daily in Columbia, South Carolina, look for the red pints and coolers at Lowe's Foods, Total Wine, Harris Teeter, and of course, Triangle Wine Company. Find out more information, go to proofalcoholicecream.com or visit any of their 200 retail locations across the Carolinas and Florida.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast.
And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.